Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
We have made these kind of decisions in the past, made one last night, and if need be, we're going to make these kind of decisions to safeguard our financial system in the future. I talked to President-elect Obama about the decision we made. I told the American people, and I told the President-elect when I first met him, that any time we were to make a big decision during this transition, he will be informed, as will his team.
Blue Monday, how are you, Blue Monday? Got to work, plan to sleep all day. Here come Tuesday, oh, Tuesday. I'm so tired, got no time to play.
It is the Savage Nation. The question today is, who broke the economy's back? Who is to blame? Who do you blame for having broken the economy's back? The phone number today on the Savage Nation is 1-800-449-8255. Topic number one, who broke the economy's back? We're going to have an interview with an economist. We're going to have an interview with my attorney about the biggest anti-terrorism verdict in American history came down less than an hour ago. The Holy Land Foundation guilty on 80 counts. Who's to blame for the economic meltdown, though, is the real problem today for most Americans. I woke up and my jaw dropped when I read that Bush and his cronies, including the Obama maniacs, are going to spend over $7 trillion to bail out their friends on Wall Street and in other institutions, all of whom are their friends. I don't think you understand what's going on, but you're witnessing the greatest theft in the history of the world. There has never been a greater theft in the history of the world, but I'll put it in another context from my point of view. And again, this is one man's opinion. It is only one man's opinion. Throw it out the window. Make yourself believe I don't know anything. Go ahead. Go listen to your newspaper counselors. Go listen to your television counselors. Go ask people who don't know they're behind from their elbow what they think. But discount what I have to say. I'm always wrong. But here's what I have to say. Bush is going to permit China to buy this country out, which he has already done. I believe that if you look at this from the point of view of buying bad debt and limited and leveraged buyouts, China has done a leveraged buyout of the United States of America. This, you're witnessing not only the greatest theft in history, but an LBO of the United States of America under the guise of you-know-what, under the guise of fiscal conservatism. George Bush, fiscal conservative, I was on to this guy years ago. I was the first guy who smelled a rat over a year ago, and I said, wait a minute now. Something's wrong with this picture. He's grown the government more than the last five administrations together. He's run a war for 8 years that won't, 5 years or 6 years won't end. The contracting is corrupt. He's expanding one government bureaucracy after another. So I said, he is a fiscal socialist. I said that a year ago. But sadly, I must report to you, dear listener of the Savage Nation, that not 6 months ago, I said to you that if you think Bush has done damage already, you are right. But you've seen nothing yet. He has several months to go. And I will say that again. If you think Bush has already done all the damage he's going to do, you're mistaken. He's not finished yet. He's got a couple of months to go. He's got all of December. And he's got 3 weeks in January. And if you think he's through screwing you, you're wrong. Now let's turn to Obama. Today he waltzes out. It looked like he was coming out to a nightclub performance. I actually was shocked. I was shocked to watch him come out looking like a combination Elvis Presley and a nightclub performer. What was the swivelly hips? I never saw the swivelly hips before. He came out like, and now, direct from Chicago. It's Barack Obama. And he walked out on the stage with that pompous look like he was going to save the world. But did he say anything today? Instead, he introduced all of the old hacks from the Clinton administration. And you morons, you idiots, you useful idiots there who thought that you were getting something new, you know what you got? You got exactly what you deserved. He's a doorman for the Clinton administration. Now let's look at this for a minute. Let's look at it really closely. What am I referring to? Who are the people I'm talking about? Let's start with Bill Clinton's Treasury Secretary, Robert Rubin. Old Bob Rubin. Old Bobby Rubin, the fly fisherman. Old Bobby Rubin is running Citibank. Old Bobby Rubin just bailed out Citibank. Citibank is going to be bailed out until it needs more money. And what do you think it's going to lead to? It's going to lead to a demand for more money. I have a question for you. How is it that in all of this talk, not one of the empty skirts in the media has said one word to Bush, one word to Obama, either yesterday or today, asking why the CEOs of these companies have not yet paid back 1 cent, asking why they have not been forced to turn over their trains, their planes, their cars, their Greenwich mansions, their Park Avenue apartments, their Florida houses? Why have they not been forced to pay a penny? The answer is because the government and they are one. The government is run by Wall Street. The government is Wall Street, and that is why we are in trouble. I woke up this morning and when I read that there was a $7 trillion bailout, I said to myself, that's unsupportable. It means our dollar has become less valuable. It means that Bush is debasing the value of the dollar. I have images of the wheelbarrows of Deutschmarks being brought to a bakery in the 1920s to buy a loaf of bread. I had terrible visions of an inflation that was out of control that led to the rise of Adolf Hitler. I have nightmares every day about what George Bush and now Obama, because they're one and the same, they're two heads to one coin, are doing to you, the average person. And now let's turn this over to you. Let's turn this over to you. What can you do about it? The answer is nothing. What can I do about it? The answer is nothing. Our votes have been stolen by both parties. Two gangs. Remember what I told you when I started in radio? When I was a little boy in the streets of New York and my father, an immigrant, although not educated but wise, said to me, Michael, here's the way the system works. You've got two bands of crooks. One band of crooks is called the Democrats. The other band of crooks is called Republicans. He said, well, one band of crooks wins. The other band stands on the outside screaming, look what they're doing. Look what they're doing. Look what they're doing. Then when the other band comes in, the other guy goes to the outside and screams, look what they're doing, look what they're doing, look what they're doing. And then he chuckled as he held my hand and he said, but you know what? In a strange way, the system works. Well, guess what, Dad? You've been in heaven a long time. The system doesn't work. We now have the most brazen crooks in the history of the world. And the little people are going to suffer in a way they can't even imagine. This is the Savage Nation. Who do you blame? That's the main question. Who's to blame for the economic meltdown? I will go back down the list with you and start from the beginning. Who broke the economy's back? Answer, we all did. Yes, I'm responsible and you're responsible. Why do I say that? Bush had an endless war that won't end. His contractor friends were corrupt. What about you with your flip your house mentality? What about all that marble and all that tile and put in the windows and double the price of the house? You're as guilty as they are. We enabled the most corrupt presidency in history to go on unstopped. All of you who supported this endless war, all of you screamed patriotism, wrapped yourself in a flag. You waved the flag and cheered the troops on. You did it. Who else did it? You on Main Street who flipped this house and doubled your profit. You the realtor who took 6% off the top on every flip. And of course, you the bankers who should all be in prison. The bankers at the top who have robbed and robbed and robbed beyond anything Willie Sutton, the master bank robber of the 1950s, ever dreamed about. All the John Gottis from Yale who have not yet gone to jail. All the Gottis from Yale who have not yet gone to jail. All the Gottis from Yale who have not yet gone to jail. And who will go to jail when all this is said and done and over? Maybe one or two middle management fall guys, and that will be it. The big fish, the Gottis from Yale, will get off scot-free. The CEOs who robbed their companies blind will go back to their homes, their cabanas, their jets. I, Michael Savage, say this cannot stand. They must be tried. They must be tried immediately. Not a club fed, but the general population of a maximum security penitentiary for them. I say when they're found guilty, their assets must be seized. Auction off their mansions, sell their Gulfstreams, use the money as security against these massive bailout plans that their companies have been given courtesy of George Bush. The economy's back is broken. America is suffering. Spread the suffering. Send the CEOs to jail. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Today, Vice President-elect Biden and I are pleased to announce the nomination of four individuals who meet these criteria to lead our economic team. Timothy Geithner as Secretary of Treasury, Lawrence Summers as the Director of our National Economic Council, Christina Romer as Chair of the Council of Economic Advisors, and Melody Barnes as Director of the Domestic Policy Council.
Let's pause right here. These Lilliputians never invented anything. Not one of these Lilliputians mentioned by Barack Obama, not one of these Lilliputians invented anything. They never introduced a new product. They never opened a new market. They never did anything that touched an ordinary person. All they did was go to expensive schools, read balance sheets, exercise regularly, take their vitamins, sit on philanthropic boards, and assume that this ride would never end. I want to refer you to the best article thus far on this subject called Obama's One Trick Wizards by Spengler, which we linked up on michaelsavage.com. That's an anonymous individual. Nobody knows who Spengler is, nor do I want to talk about it right now. I want to read you pieces from it because he's always been right. And he says this: one wants to ask the Wall Street wizards who comprise the talent pool for the Obama administration, if you so smart, how come you ain't rich no more? Manhattan's toniest private schools, harder to get into than Harvard, quietly are looking for full tuition pupils now that the children of sacked Wall Street bankers are departing for public schools in cheaper suburbs. Harvard University President Drew Faust has warned of budget cuts to come due to, quote, unprecedented losses to its $39 billion endowment. Shares of Citibank, the current firm of Bill Clinton's Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin, last week traded at less than a tenth of their year earlier market price and may require yet another federal bailout. Now, we'll get back to this in a minute. I want to go down in this article and get to where I really want to go. And here it is. Who are these people? What have they done? How much money have they made? Well, let's look at it. He says, for a quarter of a century, the inbred products of the Ivy League puppy mills have known nothing but a rising trend in asset prices. About the origin of this trend, he writes. He goes back to the Reagan administration and how he increased valuation and restored the equity market to trend by cutting taxes, which is the opposite of what Obama's going to do, which is increasing taxes. We go on and then we look at the actual characters, and this is very important. And he says this: that explains how a Washington political operative like Rahm Emanuel, now Obama's chief of staff, who studied ballet rather than balance sheets, could earn a reported $16.2 million in 2.5 years at Wasserstein Perella, the mergers and acquisitions boutique. At the height of the bubble, Bruce Wasserstein's firm sold out to Germany's Dresdner Bank for the fairy tale sum of $1.6 billion. Even the crumbs from Wasserstein's loaf could make a Chicago politician rich. Without leverage, the clever folk around Barack Obama are fleas without a dog. None of them invented anything, introduced an important new product, opened a new market, or did anything that reached into the lives of ordinary people. They wore expensive cufflinks, read balance sheets, exercised regularly, sat on philanthropic boards, and assumed that their fleas ride on the Reagan dog would last forever. And read the rest of it. Read the rest of it. If you think these people, these fleas on Reagan's dog, are going to save you, all you got to do is look at Citibank, because that's the company that Robert Rubin has been running for a while now. So I bring it back to you, folks. Who's to blame for the economic meltdown? You decide. I listen. Phone number 1-800-449-8255. It's very, very, very dangerous out there. But again, I'm going to go back to my primary insight. I haven't read this one anywhere. I want you to try to understand what buying a company based on their debt actually means. I want you to understand how these thieves developed fiduciary instruments that made no sense, but made them rich because they could keep trading these instruments amongst themselves, taking a profit each time these fake instruments traded, until now the house of cards have collapsed. Let me tell you something. Fundamentally, we are bankrupt. Fundamentally, we are in a Great Depression. The only thing keeping this afloat are these fake bailouts. What that means to you is that if your dollar had a value of 50 cents a week ago, your dollar is worth 25 cents right now, only you don't know it. We will know it very soon. If you think these fakers from Yale and from Harvard are going to save you, then you're the fool who elected Obama. But I don't blame you. I don't blame you for electing Obama, because the mantra in America was not so much to elect Obama as it was anything but Bush, anything but this bunch of crooks. Well, guess what? You got him anyway. You got him anyway. Obama's on one side of the coin. Bush is on the other side of the coin. And no matter how you spin it, it comes up as a loss for you. The phone number here is 1-800-449-8255. It goes back to dead man's pants. I'm a very lucky man in that I grew up poor. And when I grew up poor, I didn't want to be poor. I would much rather have been born to a father who was rich. In fact, I used to dream about what I would have been had my father been rich, as I worked one job after another after school to go to college, and one job after another to raise a family, and one job after another to do this and do that. I used to dream over and over again of what it would have been like to have been born rich. Well, I guess I got something to tell you. I'm glad I wasn't born rich, because then I'd be one of these sorry tyrants, one of these sorry thieves, one of these sorry crooks who have never done a thing for anybody else. All they've done is trade on their upbringing. And I, for the life of me, cannot understand how we, the people who pay their salaries, don't have the power to put them in prison. I, for one, do not understand how we don't have the power to demand that, for example, the CEO of Lehman Brothers give up his assets in order to pay down the loan. Can you explain to me why the Cretans who did this to Citibank are not forced to give up their homes, their planes, their trains to pay down the loan? Would you get a loan for nothing without collateral? Why are they?
Savage.
Question on your mind is, what should you do, and who's to blame for the economic meltdown? And of course, you're shocked that the Clintonites are back with Obama as the announcer, that there's been no fundamental change. They're the very same people who ran the Clinton White House. Right now, we have the president of Euro-Pacific Capital Inc., Peter Schiff. He predicted the recession in 2006, and he is the author of Crash Proof. Peter, welcome to the Savage Nation. You predicted that. What do you predict now, Peter?
Well, unfortunately, the government is making the problem that it created even worse with all the bailouts and economic stimulus. Unfortunately, the government still doesn't understand what's going on here. The what's happening in the economy right now, the collapse in the housing market, the collapse of consumer spending, the credit crisis, none of that is the problem. This is the consequence of the problem. The problem was that, you know, we borrowed trillions of dollars that we can't repay, and we blew the money on consumption. Now, why did we borrow all that money? Well, because the Fed dropped interest rates down to 1% and left them there for years and enabled us to borrow all this money. And we used it to buy houses, to remodel houses, to buy cars, to buy plasma TVs and iPods and take...
No, I agree with you. Let me ask you something. Are you going where I think you're going? Do you agree that I have believe we should have higher interest rates, not lower? What do you think of that?
We need much higher interest rates, because what we need in this country is to reward savings and to discourage borrowing. Americans have borrowed and spent too much money. The only
right. Well, so why is the government lowering interest rates instead of raising them?
They want to preserve the bubble economy that burst. They're trying to reinflate that. They want us shopping again. They want us going to the mall and whipping out our credit cards and buying more imported products we can't afford with money we don't have.
So instead of balancing budgets, the Obama team will be going deeper into debt by spending hundreds of billions of dollars more to stimulate the economy without any concern for deficits, without any aid to the jobless. So what are they actually doing?
Look, all they're doing is they're trying to preserve the illusion of wealth and prosperity with inflation, you know, and they're hoping that they can con the Chinese and the Japanese and the Saudis and the rest of the world into loaning us trillions of more dollars so that we can blow that along with the trillions they've already loaned us.
Well, let me ask you this. You're closer to financial markets than I am, and you would understand this better than I do. Please explain to the Savage Nation audience the concept of taking over a company by acquiring its debt, number one, or to go back to an 80s technique used by some investment types, taking over a company through a leveraged buyout. In that China owns most of our debt or a good portion of it, could China, in essence, take over America through an LBO?
Well, look, we owe the Chinese, you know, over a trillion. They have $2 trillion in reserves, over a trillion of which represent U.S. dollars. Over the next few years, we're hoping that the Chinese will loan us a trillion or two more on top of what the Japanese and the Saudis and everybody else loan us. And sure, the Chinese could use all that money to buy every single stock in the S&P 500, the entire NASDAQ and the entire Dow. You know, they can start buying up the country lock, stock, and barrel. I mean, we've basically hocked everything we have in order to consume. And the deeper in the debt we go, the greater this problem. Now, unfortunately, I guess, for the Chinese, if they ever tried to spend those dollars, they'd be practically worthless. So they wouldn't be able to buy that much. But, of course, if the dollars the Chinese are holding are worthless, the dollars that every American citizen has in the bank are worthless, too, and the value of our wages. I mean, ultimately, that's the crisis they're setting up, is a massive run on the dollar, hyperinflation. It's probably going to start sometime in this first term of Obama. And look out, because, you know, we're probably going to have price controls imposed on food, on energy, and all sorts of things, which is going to mean waiting in the line to get gas, or potentially, you know, rolling blackouts in homes and offices and long lines in the supermarket if you want to get milk. I mean, all this is going to happen because of what the government is doing.
Now, you predicted, I want to reiterate to the people, we're speaking with Peter Schiff, president of Euro-Pacific Capital, Inc., he wrote the book Crash Proof, and he predicted the recession in 2006. Is there any way out of this, Peter?
No. I mean, not unless we can invent a time machine. I mean, the damage was done.
Oh, you're my kind of guy. I like that. Okay, you're a realist, in other words.
I mean, as I said, what we're living through now are the consequences of years of reckless and extravagant borrowing and spending, caused by bad monetary policy and bad fiscal policy. It's not a fault of capitalism. It's not greedy people on Wall Street. Sure, people are greedy, but normally in a free market, the greed doesn't hurt. Only when the government interferes to eliminate the risks with really low interest rates, and when they create agencies like Freddie and Fannie that guarantee debt, they create a moral hazard, and they encourage and reward excessive risk-taking. And now we're paying the price. And we need to go back to a real economy. So, unfortunately, the solution to this problem is a massive recession with this big decline in our standard of living, where Americans lose their jobs in the service sector and find new jobs producing things and making stuff. But that transition
is going to... No, I agree with you. You know, I want to go to the medical analogy, the health and illness analogy, Peter. It's been long known that a fever is actually the body's attempt to heal itself. When the body gets hot and runs a fever, it's actually trying to kill off the invading organisms that are infecting the body. And when you suppress that fever through aspirin or some other antipyretic, by reducing the fever, you're not letting the fever burn out the toxins or the microorganism, rather, that's in your body. I believe this country needs to go through an almost deathly fever to survive. Isn't that what you're saying?
I mean, basically, I've always used the analogy of a heroin addict. I mean, basically, you're addicted to heroin, and in order to get healthy and get the heroin out of your system, you go through withdrawal. You stop taking it, and the withdrawal is a very painful, unpleasant process, but it's the only path to health. And we've been addicted to credit and borrowing and spending, and we need to go cold turkey. And unfortunately, when you do that, there's some pain, but there's light at the end of the tunnel. What the government?
Yeah, well, look, I remember the Republicans used to say, "Oh, those Democrats, all they know how to do is tax and spend, tax and spend." Then we woke up, and there was Bush borrowing and spending, building a bigger government every day. How in the world was Bush allowed to get away with this? Where was the Republican Congress on this, Peter?
under Obama, it's going to turn into print and spend because nobody's going to lend us any more money. It's just going to be print it and spend it, and it's going to be massive inflation. But like I said, we need to allow the market to function. As bad as this medicine is going to taste, we have to swallow it. Otherwise,
what about gold and oil? Why has oil come down in a time like this? Is it as simple as supply and demand? People are using less, less construction, less building, less driving, less demand for energy. Is that what's going on?
Not really. I think this is a short-term phenomenon associated with massive deleveraging, margin calls, speculators being forced out of the market. It's created a situation where prices are very low, and they're not going to stay low. Oil prices, other commodity prices, I believe once this selling pressure is off, prices are going to return to much, much higher levels. That's not going to be the case for, you know, U.S. stocks or real estate, but commodity prices are going much, much, much higher, and especially over, you know, as the years go by and we really get the impact of the inflation that is being created and will be created.
Right. So in other words, what's real is going to be even more real, and what's false is going to be even more false.
Sure. Yep.
That's pretty amazing. Peter Schiff, author of Crash Proof. Are there any last words you'd like to leave my audience on the Savage Nation?
Well, you know, as I said, I wrote this book they can look at, Crash Proof, How to Profit from a Coming Economic Collapse, a couple of years ago. They can read that. I got a new book out called The Little Book of Bull Moves and Bear Markets. If you want to see, you know, there's a YouTube video of me that's gone around last week. Almost 500,000 people have watched it in the past week. You know, Peter Schiff was right. You can Google it and check out the video. But there's 1,600 or 1,700 video clips of me on Google going back to 2004 when CNBC first started calling me Dr. Doom. I mean, you can read, you can see all this stuff.
Well, you're my kind of guy because you were right. They were wrong. The con men were wrong. But why are they bringing back Robert Rubin, who is fundamentally in charge at Citibank, who created all of these risk measures, and now he's going to run the economy for Obama? What sense does that make?
They drive the company into the ground, and then they go to Washington. And, in fact, look what's going on with this bailout of Citi. You know, you've got Paulson bailing out all his buddies on Wall Street, and with taxpayer money. And obviously, it's not even taxpayer money. They're just printing it up, which is going to just, you know, this is ridiculous. These companies should fail. Look at the salaries that Citibank lavishes on everybody. These guys.
Well, wait a minute. But you're raising a big issue here, Peter. If these companies are getting bailouts, why are they not required to put up collateral in the form of personal ownership? Meaning you're bailing out Citibank? Well, good. The Cretans who did this to Citibank, shouldn't they be forced to put up their apartments, their houses, their planes as collateral?
Even be doing it. But yeah, I mean, but why are they allowed to take the bailout money and give themselves huge bonuses? They shouldn't be. They're saying, okay, we're paying ourselves bonuses that are 50% below last year's level. Well, last year was a record high. Their bonus should be zero. Their bonus.
Well, why is the government being allowed to get away with this? Surely there are voices in Congress who agree with you and I.
But no, they're getting bonuses. They're getting huge bonuses. This is absurd. And of course, now we're going to have to bail out Detroit and GM because we're doing it for Wall Street. We shouldn't be bailing out anybody. And of course, as I said, the U.S. government.
Oh, God, it's terrible that we have no government of the people, by the people, and for the people, Peter. Who in the heck do we turn to when all of them are involved in the bailout because they're bailing each other out? What do we, the people, have to do to stop this? Peter Schiff. Bail ourselves out, and that's going to be the topic of another show very soon. Peter Schiff, S-C-H-I-F-F, thanks for being with us on the Savage Nation. But, well, you know, I appreciate it. I really do, Peter. He did make sense. He's an honest guy who apparently knows what he's talking about. More than I can say about the jerks who went to Yale who know only how to rob you blind and tell you that they're doing something good for you. Now, I'm going to have to go back to my worldview. If you think I'm a poor man, you're mistaken. If you think I'm a rich man, you're wrong. I'm doing as well as I need to be doing in this world. But I started as an immigrant son, and I've had a lot of blows in my life and a lot of false starts and a lot of years wasted. And now I want to tell you that the people who are running the country don't know as much as I do about basic economics. And why do I say that? Well, let me explain it to you. Isn't it true in your life that if you invested in a business deal and the business deal went up in smoke, you lost money, and you took you years to recover? Isn't it also true that there were times in your life that you spent money on things that you invested in certain things that, other than a business, let's say, an investment, and the investment went sour? Did anyone bail you out? How about when you lost a job? Did the government come to help you? In all of those cases in my life, I've had downturns, and I've had to pay for it. I've been down many times, but I had to pull myself back up. There was no government to pull me back up. A government that pulls you back up is a socialist government. By all definition, we're living in a high socialist government. We are no different than Hugo Chavez's country right now. There is no difference between the fun face of Obama and the unfun face of Hugo Chavez. We are living in a centralized economy. We are living in the socialization of major industries, including banks, which is a classic move of a socialist dictatorship. And I am telling you that this is going to impact you in ways you can't even imagine. And what can we do to stop it? I'm not quite sure we can. But if there are ways to stop it, we're the only ones who can do it, because these schmucks from Yale don't know their suspenders from their you-know-what. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Rubin, the man who busted Citibank, is now in charge at Obamaland. Muslim charity defendants guilty on all counts. We'll discuss that in the next hour. And you can also go to my website and see the $5,000 check, a copy of it, the seed money sent by the Holy Land Foundation to give a start to that group, CAIR. And you know an awful lot about CAIR. We're going to talk about that in the next hour. There are other stories that you must look at on michaelsavage.com. The biggest one is that insiders reveal that Citigroup ignored risk, made bigger bets on bad mortgages. Robert Rubin encouraged this, and now he's BO's advisors. You have to read these stories if you're interested in what's going on. On the bottom of the website, there's a picture of a pirate ship on fire. My headline is very clear: How India Treats Pirates While Bush Fiddles. And the article says the United States has been particularly feeble. Contrast all this with the confident clarity coming from India. We are a nation run by imbeciles and weaklings, and apparently you don't even know it. But I'll take your calls at 1-800-449-8255. Jeff on WOR, go ahead. Who do you blame?
I mean, American people definitely have been living beyond their means for a long time. I mean, of course, the companies are guilty for putting the bait on the line and hanging it in front of their faces. But I mean, people just, you know, have to understand you.
Jeff, look, I grew up in a very frugal household. We had one car. We took one vacation a year by car. We had one house that my father paid for all his life. We didn't have a vacation house and an investment house. I just think that the country's going to contract economically, and we're going to go back to maybe the 50s prior to the go-go years of the 60s. We'll still live. We'll just live on less. How hard is that?
Well, how about layaway? That's what I remember, buying stuff when I was a kid. You couldn't afford it. My mother put it on layaway.
Isn't a credit card a layaway plan in the same way?
Well, in the way it is, but people are doing it.
I hear what you're saying. In other words, you didn't get the object till you paid it off. Layaway, they kept it for you.
Yeah, you had to save. Nobody knows how to save. The American dream is to work hard, earn your money, not charge everything.
Okay, you say it's the American people. I want to read to you Dead Man's Pants, a few paragraphs from it, because people keep referring to this story. People you'd never expect led lives like I did. And I want to talk about it for a couple of reasons. One, because I'm still living, even though I had to wear Dead Man's Pants. Although I did not go to Yale, although my parents didn't fight to get me into a snotty day school to get me ahead in life. And I guarantee you, if you did a retrospective study of the kids who get into these snotty schools, I wonder what percentage of them actually wind up achieving anything in life, as opposed to kids who went to city colleges like I did. I once did a study, my own study, of all the people I know. Now, maybe it's because of my class background. I really don't know. But it seems to me all the people I met who ever achieved anything in life either went to state schools, city schools, or no schools at all. And the jerks who went to Harvard usually amounted to living on their wife's income. The schmucks that I know went to Harvard usually do nothing, and they're living on their wife's money or their wife's work, while sitting at home and pontificating. That's been my experience. I don't know about yours. But let me read you from Dead Man's Pants, from my new book, Psychological Nudity. Incidentally, and I have to say this once, and I'll only say it once to my loyal audience, I lowered the price on the books of $2 a piece, not because it's worth $2 less, but because I wanted to reward those of you who bought the first printing the first edition, first printing. I told you there'd be no others. I could have cheated you, and I could have reprinted the book and still said first printing on it, but I didn't. I like to reward people and keep it as honest as I can. So you're going to get the first edition, second printing. Does it mean it's less valuable? Inherently, no. In the long run, maybe. That's all there is to it. So I lowered the price by $2 to reward those of you who bought the first printing. Here we go. Growing up in the Bronx as I did, I didn't have many of the luxuries most kids with their hats on back would take for granted today. And I go on, and as a kid, I'd line up my shoes under my bed at night, neat like in the military. I made sure they were polished. I'm sure some shrink today would say I suffered from ADD or other compulsive behavior disorders and should have been put on a regimen of Ritalin simply for keeping my shoes shine. I wonder what they'd say, though, about the fact that through most of my youth I wore secondhand pants from dead men. Many of the pants I wore as a preteen came out off of stiffs, cut down to fit me. Now, don't get me wrong. My father was a good man. He ran a small antique store with mostly 19th century stuff. On the side, at least, in the beginning, he sold used goods as well. A man's got to do what a man's got to do to make ends meet, right? Occasionally, he'd go to an auction after a man died and buy the entire estate, the clocks, the dishes, the mirrors, whatever the man had, the pants, the shirts, the whole deal. You get the picture. Back at the store, as he sorted the stuff for resale, he'd take a closer look at the suit. Once he got a Hart Shafter and Mark suit from a dead man. Now, what's he going to do? Toss it in the garbage like they do today? In those days, it wasn't in him to throw out a good worsted fabric. Instead, he brought home the pants to me. I remember my father called me to the bedroom and showed them to me like a head tailor at Nordstrom's department store. He'd say, "Now, Michael, get a good look at the fabric." I wanted to vomit. I got a migraine because I knew what was coming. "Take a look at the quality of this fabric." He's working me like a salesman. He's unrolling the pants on the bed. I can see it to this day. He unrolls it like he's selling me a bolt of hand-woven cloth. He would say, "You can't get fabric like this just anywhere." I wanted to say, "Of course not, Dad. They only sell stuff like that for men who died. You know, it was like special clothing from The Undertaker." Even if I had said something, that wouldn't have changed anything. He'd go downtown, the pants would come back fit for me, you know, shortened, without the legs taken in properly at the crotch or in the behind. They ended up baggy like an Abbott and Costello pair of pants. Even if they had fit me properly, there was something repugnant about the whole idea. Let me pause right there, because I wanted you to understand what it was like to wear dead man's pants. But guess what? It didn't do me any harm. Not at all. I'm sitting here, and thank God I didn't rob anybody.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
While we can't underestimate the challenges that we face, we also can't underestimate our capacity to overcome them, to summon that spirit of determination and optimism that has always defined us, and to move forward in a new direction to create new jobs, reform our financial system.
All right. I turn it off. I don't even want to listen to it. More of the same double talk. Look who he hires on his team. Have you seen a list of people? They're either out of the Clinton administration or out of communist think tanks. He chooses Melanie Barnes, from the Center for American Progress, a group funded by George Soros, to be on his economic recovery team. He chooses Larry Summers, who has a stellar background, Larry Summers. All you got to do is look into it. And you'll find that Larry Summers has been several Larry Summers. They don't know what they're doing. Do you understand that they've just been riding on the coattails of the Reaganomics? As Spengler said, they're just puppy mills. He said these are the inbred products of the Ivy League puppy mills who have known nothing but a rising trend in asset prices. And he said about the origin of the trend that they've been riding on, they were incurious. Are you aware of the fact that Rahm Emanuel, the clever man who is now chief of staff for Barack Obama? Do you know anything about his background? Forget about the fact of the fact that his father fought with the Irgun in Israel. That'll tell you off the bat exactly everything you need to know about things, but which is not a bad thing. I'm glad that they're on that side rather than on the side of Hamas. So let me put it to you that way. But if you actually look at the man who poses as a liberal, you will find out that he made quite a bit of money himself. I'm talking about his chief of staff. Look at Robert Rubin. Ask yourself why he was just hired by Barack Hussein Obama. Here is a man who's been running Citigroup, Rubin. Here is a man who expanded all of the fiduciary instruments so that they could keep trading and trading and trading and making money. And yet, at the end of the day, this house of cards has come crashing down. And Citigroup will have more than $300 billion of troubled mortgages and other assets guaranteed by the U.S. government under a federal plan to stabilize the lender after its stock fell 60% last week. Citigroup will also get a $20 billion cash infusion from the Treasury Department, adding to the $25 billion the bank received last month under the TARP program. And what are you going to get in return for the cash and guarantees? You're going to get $27 billion of preferred shares paying an 8% dividend. Truly. Now, who is Robert Rubin? Why has he been picked? Why? Because these people all pick each other. They all know each other. But you think that they're wizards? They're not wizards. They busted out the companies that they worked for. Former Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin was an architect of Citibank's strategy. The New York Times reported in a long article on November 23rd. In 2005, as Citigroup began its effort to expand from within, Robert Rubin peppered his colleagues with questions as they formulated the plan. According to current and former colleagues, he believed that Citigroup was falling behind rivals, and he pushed the company to bulk up the bank's high-growth fixed-income trading, including the structured credit business. Former colleagues said that Robert Rubin also encouraged Charles Prince to broaden the bank's appetite for risk, provided that it also upgraded oversight, though the Federal Reserve later would conclude that the bank's oversight remained inadequate. So the fact of the matter is, these people did not know what they were doing, and now they're going to take over the economy. Doesn't that worry you? Well, it should worry you, but I don't think you can do anything about it, so what's the point of worrying about it? Incidentally, in the same article, Mr. Spengler says, "This explains how a Washington political operative like Rahm Emanuel, now Obama's chief of staff, who studied ballet rather than balance sheets, could earn a reported $16.2 million in 2.5 years at Wasserstein Perella, the mergers and acquisitions boutique. At the height of the bubble, Bruce Wasserstein's firm sold out to Germany's Dresdner Bank for the fairy tale sum of $1.6 billion. Even the crumbs from Wasserstein's loaf could make a Chicago politician rich." And he asks, how can they get away with it? He goes on, he says, "Without leverage, the clever folk around Barack Obama are fleas without a dog. None of them invented anything, introduced an important new product, opened a new market, or did anything that reached into the lives of ordinary people." He said they wore expensive cufflinks, they read balance sheets, they exercised regularly, they sat on philanthropic boards, and assumed that their fleas ride on the Reagan dog would last forever. That's what we're facing today. These are empty suits, and now they're going to be running the country the way George Bush's empty suits ran the country. So, as I said to you, all you got here is a changing of the guard. You haven't had a change in the underlying philosophy or mentality of the jerks from Harvard and Yale. The very same empty suits who busted America out are going to bust it out even further. Unlike Bush, who borrowed and spent, I think that Obama maniacs are going to tax and borrow and spend. Yes, they're going to tax the rich. Now, who are the rich? Well, that would be you. Anybody who's not on welfare will be a target of Obama. Anybody who earns more than $100,000 per head, that means $200,000 per household, any business that makes more than $250,000, and by the way, any business that doesn't make more than $250,000 is not making enough money to be worth running a business for, incidentally. In other words, if you're not grossing more than $250,000, I didn't say net, I said gross, you're a target of Obama's tax increase. So don't fall for this double talker's lies. He said he's going to tax the rich. That means anybody who doesn't work for the government and anybody who doesn't receive a government handout is going to be taxed by Obama to pay for Bush's follies. There are solutions. What are the solutions? No more bailouts, number one. Prison time for the culprits, number two. A seizure of the assets of the CEOs of any company that committed crimes. Which company committed crimes? Virtually all of them being bailed out. They all went around the law. They skirted the law. They invented new laws. They wrote themselves around the law. They should all be indicted and tried. The problem is their friends from Harvard and Yale run the SEC. That's why nothing is happening. That's why not one of these corporate gangsters has been indicted. That's why not one of these corporate criminals has had so much as a car taken from them. Never mind an apartment on Park Avenue. Never mind their house in Greenwich. Never mind their beachfront house in Palm Beach. Never mind their fleet of airplanes. Not so much as one SUV has been taken from any of these crooks. So if you think this is going to be resolved, you're crazy. You're out of your mind. We have no government. We have instead government anarchy right now. We have government anarchy. They have abrogated their responsibilities to the people. I don't have a solution to you right for you right now. Perhaps I will one day. The phone number here is 1-800-449-8255. There are other stories. I don't think there are any stories that are more important than this, obviously. I think this is the only story anybody is interested in, which is economics. Everybody's panicked. Who broke the economy's back? Who's to blame for the economic meltdown? I won't even introduce the other topics because I think there's too much for you to handle. When I woke up this morning and I read that the government, whoever they are, that means this group of cretins from Yale and Harvard, agreed to bail out their friends from Yale and Harvard to the tune of $7.1 trillion, I started running around the house saying it's Weimar Germany all over again. It's Weimar Germany all over again. It doesn't look like that, but it's liable to become like that. What do I mean by Weimar Germany? Well, socially, we're far worse, more degenerate than Weimar Germany. At least in Weimar Germany, men couldn't marry men, and women couldn't marry women. So we're probably 10 leagues below the degeneracy that brought about Hitler. We're probably 50 leagues below the degeneracy that brought about Hitler. We are the sickest, most disgusting country on the earth, and we are psychotic as a nation. It's a psychotic nation when the Attorney General of the state of California, when the senator from the state of California named Dianne Feinstein, when the governor from the state of California who posed as a strong man gets up there and says that homosexuals have a right to marry that's equal to a man and a woman, they're insane. They are fundamentally insane, and they're stealing your vote. Now, what do I mean by they're stealing your vote? Here in the state of California, we went to the ballot. And we voted against gay marriage, plain and simple. We said marriage is what it's always been. That is between a man and a woman. And it won by a very large margin. It proved once again that the lying, thieving, stealing pollsters work for the homosexual mafia and the Democrat Party. And I stand by those words. Every one of those polls said it was going to lose. I knew they were lying. I know who they are. I know every one of these people, like the back of my hand. We won it fair and square. And yet Attorney General Jerry Brown, Moonbeam, who's been posing as a centrist, has the audacity as Attorney General to say, I'm not going to support this ballot initiative, even though that's my duty. Do you know that an Attorney General is supposed to make certain that he supports a ballot initiative that is voted upon? That's his job. Instead, he said he's going to argue before the California Supreme Court and say that, no, he wants it overturned. In other words, he's doing a criminal act. He is acting as a criminal would. What would you say if your father said the country was invaded and they invalidated your ballot? What would you say if your father told you the day would come that you'd wake up and a group of degenerate thieves would rob Wall Street blind and tax you for it and none of them would go to jail? What would your father or grandfather who fought in World War II say if a bunch of degenerates would tell you that your vote is invalid and you have no vote? I'll let you ponder that as I take a break. Savage. Show you how far good is. You probably saw a story that says charity defendants guilty on all counts. They left out the key word, which is Muslim. They're not allowed to say the obvious word. It's the most important verdict of the last number of years. In about 35 minutes after the hour, we're going to have my attorney on to talk about the indictments that came down today against the Holy Land Foundation. Right now, I want to cool it down a bit and go into a slightly different direction. And I want to read a review that just came out on Psychological Nudity by Barbara Anderson. I'm not going to bore you with the whole review, although the whole review is so well written. that it would be worth reading, but I'm just going to read you excerpts, okay? And here it is. True to his independent spirit, Savage brought the book to his readers without the benefit of a go-between publisher. The experience of having written over 25 previous books has resulted in knowing his way around the publishing world. Without the help of the mainstream media, he has promoted it modestly and has been rewarded with orders. All Savage's titles are provocative, and you want to find out what is hiding behind them. One is Love by the Sewer Plant. It is a story about what is dear to most people, their first love. Savage describes how his own first love happened by the unromantic venue of the sewer plant. One day, a group of entertainers came around and just stared at this girl. They came running up to her as if I wasn't there. I was holding her hand and walking with her. We were just kids. One of them said, "Man, I wanted you to see this girl. This is the girl I was telling you about." They looked at her like she was a specimen of biblical beauty. So we two kids walked down the hill, crossed the river, roll up the dungarees, take off our shoes. Our legs were blue from the cold water in the river. And we have a little bit of passion together. It was my first moment of passion, and not exactly on the level of a complete moment of passion. But for me, it was the first of that type, so now I'm starstruck. She says, "There is a scarcity of words about this encounter, but you know exactly what he's talking about and can feel his emotions. This is as risque as it gets in psychological nudity. He has depended on imagination all his life and expects you to do the same here." And I want to pause right now. I aim not to use one four-letter word in the book, not one dirty word, because I'm not Chris Rock. I'm not one of the low-life vermin that HBO chooses to put in your face, because I know who they are. I know who runs HBO. I know who runs Showtime. They're the same filth who pumped the sewer pipe into your living room. These degenerate sickos are all the money behind same-sex marriage, if you get the drift. And since they live in a sewer, that's the product they put out for you day in and day out. But I have proven over and over again, you don't have to use dirty words to get people to read your book or listen to your talk show, which is why I am being targeted by George Soros. These men, and it's going to get right back to the economics, these men are such clever devils that they found out a long time ago that if you satisfy the masses with filth and with drugs, you can subdue the masses. And so they have pumped nothing but filth into your head through HBO, Showtime, Internet. They have pacified you with marijuana and drugs in order to turn you into a slave. You are no higher than the Chinese coolie was before the Boxer Rebellion. I don't have the time to go into what the Boxer Rebellion meant or what it means or what it might mean for our country at this time. I will get there at another time. I just want to reiterate, most Americans have now been sated with marijuana, with other drugs, prescription and illegal drugs, and with unremittent pornography day and night. This is all a plan of men like George Soros. And the reason I say that is because I can prove it. George Soros, now one of the biggest players in the world because he elected Barack Obama, George Soros funded marijuana legalization initiatives in California and in Arizona for many, many years. I don't believe that he did it because he cared a whit about the medical uses of marijuana. I think he did it because he knows that foolish people, gullible people, will be even more foolish and more gullible if they smoke dope. And of course, it's named dope because it makes you a bigger dope than you already are. And now you are a slave. Between that and what you didn't learn in school, between that and what you didn't learn in school and the filth that comes into your house from HBO and the other networks, you are in essence a modern-day coolie. This ties directly into the fact that you elected Obama, and then you woke up to find out that he chose Clintonistas to run the government. And what I love is that the sycophants in the media had the nerve to say, Obama chooses seasoned insiders to run government. Not one of these little Lilliputians in the media said, Obama chooses Clintonistas to run government. Instead, you sorrowful bunch of bums in the midstream media choose to cover up the fact that even you were hoodwinked by your own lies and your own dreams. Pennsylvania, Damien, you're on the Savage Nation.
Hi, Michael. I'm 30 years old. I have two small children. I'm so irate, and this is what we need. We need a Churchill, and we need a Patton, And I'm going to tell you, this entire...
Well, let's start with Patton. We don't have a Patton running the Joint Chiefs of Staff. We have an MBA who doesn't know how to fire a gun on a Navy ship. He didn't know what to do. He sat with his finger in his mouth while Somali pirates were breaking into ships, and he talked with his big voice, his big Hollywood voice, and he let the Indian Navy do what he should have been doing. It's a disgrace what's happened to the U.S. military, and I blame one man, the commander in grief, George W. Bush.
Savage.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation. The other big story today, and it is a very big story, but I don't think it'll get the play it deserves because of the supine press, the sellout press, the propagandist press, is that a Muslim charity and defendants of the Muslim charity have been found guilty on all counts. It's a huge story about the Holy Land case. Daniel Horowitz, please explain to the audience quickly, what does this really mean for the average American?
It means that we've stopped... once and for all, the farce, the fake claim that these Muslim charities are helping poor people in Palestine. And we've proven to the entire world what you and I have known is true, Michael, that these groups fund Hamas, they fund terror, they fund the political machine of terror in the Mideast, and it reaches all the way to the United States.
All right, well, you're talking now about the Holy Land Foundation. What were they found guilty of?
They were found guilty of... in total, with the five defendants and the charity, charity itself, of 108 separate charges, tax evasion, money laundering, supporting terrorism. But, Michael, the most important point, and you know this, this Holy Land Foundation is the brother organization of your friends in CARE. They were formed from the same terrorist organization, the Muslim Brotherhood, and we have the documents as part of your lawsuit, to show that they are tied at the hip together.
Well, how does this affect CARE at all?
First of all, who do you think was banging on the drums, forming these groups, fighting this prosecution? It was the head of CARE Texas under some phony organization that he formed to make believe it was citizens concerned about the prosecution. But more than that, Michael, let's look at the Holy Land Foundation. I have in my hand, as we speak, a wire transfer, $5,000 of seed money to CARE, to found CARE. Who sent?
Hold on. I put that up on my website. Is that legal to put up that check?
It is. It's from the Holy Land Foundation. CARE was started with $5,000 from the Holy Land Foundation. How about?
So who is going to now bring a case against CARE to link them to the Holy Land Foundation? Can someone do that?
The government may do it because CARE was named as a conspirator in this Holy Land trial, but they weren't named as a charged conspirator. There's a whole separate document in this case listing all of the people, Omar Ahmad, who's one of the founders of CARE, CARE itself, as being unindicted co-conspirators, meaning that they're guilty, they're part of it, but the government is not at this time.
Well, Daniel, I withdrew my case, even though you wrote up a great brief on a RICO statute, and I withdrew my lawsuit because of security concerns. You know that, and I know that, and we don't have to spell that out. But if somebody were to bring a similar RICO claim against CARE, do you think they could prevail today?
Oh, I think so, Michael. I mean, I think that the 9/11 victims could take CARE's webpage, which I have in my hand, where they're soliciting money for the victims and survivors of 9/11. And do you know where that money went to?
The no.
Foundation. I have it in my...
Well, all I know is that CARE went to my advertisers and told them I was a bad guy and they were the good guy. You think some of these advertisers ought to be made aware of their connections to the Holy Land Foundation?
I think that they should. I think you're in so much business they're bankrupt by now because they're not on your show.
Well, I won't comment on a former advertiser, but I will say this. I was shocked when you called me and told me that the Holy Land Foundation had been found guilty on 80 counts because I thought this country was finished and could not make a proper decision. I also thought that with the changing of the guard, with the movement towards Obama, they'd get a walk. And that brings me to the next question. Do you think they will appeal and it'll be shopped to an Obama, a judge?
Well, I think they kind of peeled, but, you know, I hope they get a nice liberal judge like Judge Ilston, who reviewed your fee fight with care and voted in your favor. Because, look, Michael, I've looked at the entire transcript of the first Holy Land trial that was a hung jury. I've spoken to the prosecutor. I've looked at all the evidence, and it is just ironclad. Here's what they do, Michael. They raise money saying, we want to help widows and orphans. Well, guess what? The widows and orphans are the widows and orphans of suicide bombers. And they did that at this trial.
Unbelievable. So they were faking it. Yeah. There was another article that came out last night, a WorldNet Daily, of CARE shocked at annual dinner by subpoenas for criminal fraud. What was that about?
Oh, Michael, I you know, you direct me to their website, and I watched the video. Apparently, they had a non-lawyer, a guy who was a fake lawyer, and they kept referring people to him and insisting that people who are supposedly under their protection use this lawyer. And now people are suing CARE, saying, you sent us to this phony lawyer. Did you get kicked? Why did you do it? And so on.
Well, so the big story today is that this Muslim charity and defendants were guilty on all counts. What is going to happen to them? What will their punishment likely be?
Prison. These people have long histories of being involved in terrorism. One of these guys, Baker, and is on FBI tapes going back to 1993. These people helped form CARE. These are the very people who helped form CARE. And they form other terror organizations.
No, but I mean, are they going to be punished if they've been found guilty, or is this a slap on the wrist coming?
They're going to prison. They'll be in prison for 5-10 years. This is really the start of something. Americans are sick and tired of these fake Muslim charities. They all do it. These terrorists set up fake Muslim charities. They go to regular American Muslims, normal people. They give them a line. They take the money. And instead of using it for good, they use it for terror. Look, if you're an American, you want to give money to help what goes on, these poor people, you see their suffering. You give it to these people, they buy guns and they kill folks. And this is over. It's over. This is a very monumental day for America.
80 counts? They were found guilty on 80 counts, Daniel?
It could be as much as 108. Every count they were found
guilty. I hear that some of their family members broke down in tears in the courtroom. Is that true?
Oh, yeah, they broke down in tears, and the AP reporter is basically a shill for the Islamists. I mean, he keeps writing these articles, making it like they're poor, hurt people.
Oh, they were picked on because of their religion, I see, by an evil, racist white government. Is that it?
And they're just family people, and they just are trying to do good in the Middle East. But I've read these people, Michael. They deliberately give money to terror to kill, and they put this fake charitable facade. It's what CARE does. CARE is a fake charity. Holy Land is a fake charity. They were invented in 1993 by the Muslim Brotherhood, which is part of Hamas. It's just their scam, and the scam is breaking down. CARE is on its way out, too, Michael. Same reason.
Wow. Daniel Horowitz, thank you very much for enlightening the audience on the Savage Nation.
Thank you for everything you've done to fight terrorism.
Oh, God. Thanks, Dan. Okay, here's another little story for you. Microchips planned for AIDS patients. That's right. Not in America, of course. We wouldn't want that. We believe in freedom. But lawmakers in Indonesia's remote province of Papua have thrown their support behind a controversial bill requiring some HIV/AIDS patients to be implanted with microchips. Mainly the predatory infected will be implanted. And, of course, they're being criticized. They want to tag sexually aggressive HIV-positive patients with small computer chips beneath the skin of these sexually aggressive patients in order to make the government better at position to identify, track, and ultimately punish those who deliberately infect others with up to 6 months in jail. But, of course, it is being roundly condemned by the health workers and rights activists who say that it invades privacy. People with AIDS aren't animals. We have to respect their rights, said Tahi Ganang Budababata, a prominent Papuan activist. He gave the standard double talk, saying the best way to tackle the epidemic was through increased spending on sexual education and condom use. Yeah, it's done an awful lot in America, hasn't it? Yeah, sex education and condoms have really slowed the rate of disease in America. Sure. Oh, sure. Read all about it on michaelsavage.com. Let's go to Portland, Oregon on any topic that you want to talk to me about or to the people about on the Savage Nation, 1-800-449-8255. You want to talk economy, you want to talk Holy Land, you want to talk AIDS, you want to talk, let's see, what else do I have that's on a little different topic? Mainly it's the economics here. Here's one that just came out. Judge tosses appeal of a condemned killer who didn't want the appeal. Here's a guy who tortured two young siblings to death who wanted to die, and his rat lawyers continued to want to appeal for him after he himself said he deserved to die for what he had done. So in other words, in this case, the lawyers are the criminals. West Virginia, Keith, you're on the Savage Nation.
Yeah, Michael, I just wanted to congratulate you on your book, Psychological Nudity. I just find it so refreshing to know that you don't have to use all the vulgar language. I'm 51 years old, and when I listen to you talk, I don't mean you take this the wrong way. It reminds me of Red Skelton, who always said that you didn't have to use the vulgarity and the profanity to make stories interesting and funny. I've never read the...
Steve Allen said the same thing. He fought all of his life, Steve Allen, a great entertainer, to eliminate the vile words in Hollywood that were coming up. He was able to entertain without reverting to rubbing his crotch or using the F word in the back of a limo with gold chains hanging from his neck.
Exactly, and it's just so nice to know that there's somebody out there that has those moral values that I was raised on. And like I said, I've never...
Well, you see, you and I come from the same time in America and from the same background in the sense of the same values. I had a fellow over on my boat today who's a diesel mechanic, a lovely man, and he grew up in Indiana. It's very funny. We're from different cultural backgrounds, but we have the same social values. And that's the thing I'm trying to say here. Most of America still has these values. You'd be surprised how many people still see the world this way. We're actually the majority, Keith. We are the silenced, not the silent, but the silenced majority. It's the degenerates. It is the perverts. It's the drug addicts. It's the real evil people who control the media, Keith. You know that, and I know that. And they do it specifically to brainwash the children into using more drugs, to absorbing more pornography in order to keep them enslaved. This is addiction. This is slavery, Keith. It has nothing to do with freedom. It is slavery. Thanks for the call. So I'm a little worked up right now, but I want to read something else that you probably haven't heard yet, because I think it's a cultural statement that goes beyond my book. I want to read you two paragraphs. Barbara Innocent writes, in Political Museums and the Downfall of Western Culture, she writes, Savage points out that museums have become politically correct and not solely devoted to the beauty of art. Because his father had an antique store, he became well acquainted with museums and appreciated the art he found there. However, Savage points out that he quit going because, quote, too many exhibits became propaganda, not art. They put a basket from Guatemala next to a Rembrandt, and they tell you they're culturally equal. You hear? Nevertheless, the European collections are still there if you look for them, and they still stand out, and they are still worth going to see. Savage then describes his visit to a museum. So let me begin at the end. I left the museum after 2 hours and came out feeling enlightened. I used the word enlightened in the way it truly was written and meant to be understood. I felt lighter inside. My spirit was lifted from association with great art. I stood nose to nose with Hopper and Church and other great artists. You know, the sight of a painting an inch from the oil paint is an astonishing thing to behold. You can literally feel the movements of the brush. It does something to your mind that you can't compare with anything else, certainly not television or a movie. Here, Savage's words again are poetic. It makes you want to visit a museum and get right up close to see the swirling of the brush marks by the masters. And she concludes by saying, in Psychological Nudity, Michael Savage has pulled out all the stops. He has used all the literary skills he possesses. From a writer's viewpoint, a recognition of these skills brings admiration. From a reader's viewpoint, they have produced a cornucopia of stories told by a master. I got to tell you, she's right. And the reason you're not reading about this book in any of the newspapers is because they all work for the other side. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Bye.
I believe we need a pretty big package here. I believe we need a pretty big package here. I believe we need a pretty big package here. I believe we need a pretty big package here. I believe we need a pretty big package here. I believe we need a pretty big package here.
Well, I don't know whether he spent too much time in San Francisco, but, you know, it's interesting to me how this stimulus, even the word stimulus and pretty big package and all that, it's all in a sexual connotation. This is so Freudian, it's unbelievable to me. But I won't go into it at this point because I think I made my point without going into it. You understand what I'm saying to you or not? New York City, WOR, Mark, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, Michael, some of the best radio ever, an hour and a half for you and probably in all radio history, and it's so important for America. Put so many different topics together. Michael, you talk about your father. I grew up in Akron, Ohio. We used to drive from Akron up to the ballgame in Cleveland and past the flats where all the steel companies were. And the smell and the flames used to startle me when I was 6 or 7 years old. My father was in the manufacturing. He used to say, as long as you see the smoke and the flames going up, everything is okay.
Wow. That is so beautiful. The only thing that comes to mind when you say that is, you know, it's funny, I was talking about museums. There's a great Edward Hopper painting called The Steelworkers that was probably set in Akron, Ohio. It was it's unbelievable. It shows lean men during a break outside a steel mill. You know, they would look today like, let us say, boxers, you know, or martial artists without tattoos before they started to destroy themselves with skin markings. But, yeah, whatever happened to the steel mills?
Well, it's like I'm a simple social studies teacher here in New York City. I know you used to teach in the inner city here. And just going over, I'm not a great economist, just going over with my kids the simple chapters about the Depression, about the margins, buying on margin and people. And
They understood it, right? The kids knew it. In other words, if you let people buy without a margin, they start speculating beyond their means. How intelligent do you have to be to figure it out? Apparently Robert Rubin didn't learn that when he went to Yale or Harvard.
Because they're all yes men in those schools of economics for the last 30 or 40 years when they said we didn't need manufacturing anymore. Those kids were just yes men.
I have another book for you to read your kids if you're teaching in an inner city school. Did you ever read yourself, if you didn't, this is a great one, 2 years Before the Mast? Do you know that book?
No. Say what the name of it is again.
2 years Before the Mast. And was it Hawthorne who wrote it? I could be wrong on that one. I'm not sure. Beowulf, look it up. I'm sorry, Richard Henry Dana wrote it? Okay, sorry about that. Same era. He wrote that the sea is my Harvard and my Yale, and he talked about not going to college. It was, you know, he was from New England. And instead of going to Harvard or Yale, he took a job aboard a whaling ship, and he said that the sea is my Harvard and my Yale. Now, that would appeal to a kid who comes from a poor family. He'd understand that, that he doesn't have to go to a great so-called university, which is nothing but an institution of lower living. You know what they teach him there the first week during orientation? That it's okay if you're a woman to sleep with your sorority sister. If you're a boy, they teach you to experiment, open yourself up, and see what it's like to sleep with your brother. And they give you condoms. That's what these degenerate institutions have become. They're all worthless. You're better off sending your kid to a state school, I guarantee you.
Kids are like guinea pigs. Michael, my father used to say, real wealth is made when you take a natural resource and manufacture something from it. We can't just have nail salons and all these...
Ask the kids what they want to be today in America. They all want to be a web designer or a movie star, you hear? They can't drive a nail. They can't turn a screw. They can't saw a piece of wood. What are they useful for?
100 of these guys with MBAs aren't worth one engineer, real engineer. Engineer, Michael.
Engineer, I had a leak in my boat over the weekend, a small water leak, so I had my mechanic down. Right, before he got there, he knew what it was, and he confirmed it, okay, like a water pump, whatever. So I said to him, Tom, who's going to be doing this job of diesel mechanics after, you know, you retire? I said, who's learning this today? I said, are they teaching kids how to be a mechanic in America? I know that in Mexico, there are trade schools where they teach the kids, for example, how to fix an engine. Our country doesn't even have a school like that anymore. When I went to school in New York City, there were three streams. You could have academic, commercial, or so-called vocational. And many kids went to vocational high school. They learned how to be a carpenter, an electrician, a plumber. Or if they wanted to be in a commercial world, they went to commercial school to learn various skills and whatnot. Why don't we have that anymore? I'll tell you why. Because the idiots in the 60s came along and said it's unfair to segregate the kids out. Everybody's a potential Einstein. You hear this? Everybody's a potential Einstein. Well, no, we all know that not everyone's a potential Einstein. There are alphas, betas, gammas, and deltas. Not all of them can be an Einstein. And we need good deltas, we need good betas, and we need good gammas. Instead, all we got today are Charles Schumers. Play Charles Schumer for us on the Savage Nation. That's all I want to hear is Charles Schumer.
I believe we need a pretty big package here. First, I think that Congress will work with the president-elect
starting. He needs a big package. All right, we'll send him to San Francisco to see if he can find a big package in Gavin Newsom's City Hall, because maybe that's where he'll find the package that he needs to save America.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Do I have to start singing 15 men on a dead man's chest, yo-ho-ho, and a bottle of rum? Welcome to the Savage Nation. While we're getting the music ready, I'm going to talk about who is to blame for the economic meltdown. We're talking about who broke the economy's back. Who do you really blame? We had an interview with an expert on this subject. We had my attorney on with the big Holy Land Foundation case, the Muslim charity that was uncovered for what it is. And if you have to this topic or any other topic in your head, call me at 1-800-449-8255. Guys, have you found the song yet? Because I really feel like singing a dead
man on a dead man's chest. Yo-ho-ho and a bottle of rum. Drink and the devil have done for the rest. Yo-ho-ho and a bottle of rum. Bottle of rum.
Bottle of rum. Welcome back, or welcome to the Savage Nation. I love this song. Skip Henderson out of Alameda, California, did this CD. Probably, I hope he's selling them as a result of my show. Anyway, here we are. Here we are. Here we are. Weimar is just around the corner. Weimar is just around the corner. The wheelbarrow and the barrel of money to buy a loaf of bread. I mean, it's a nightmare scenario. I admit it. And of course, you may say, well, it could never happen here. Why can't it happen here? Why can't it happen here when you got a government that has borrowed trillions of dollars and now wants to borrow trillions more to bail out the vermin on Wall Street, the vermin with suspenders from Yale, the vermin with suspenders from Harvard? Why can't it happen here when they're unwilling to tighten their belt, cut government, cut spending, indict and arrest the CEOs that did this to us? Why can't it happen here? We keep asking ourselves. And the answer is, of course, it can happen here. And that's why we are all worried. We, the people, are in a panic right now. And if you're not in a panic, you're probably a fool. If you're not wondering what you should do with your hard-earned savings, if you're not wondering with some concern about whether or not you're going to have a job or a business a year from now, then you probably work for the U.S. government. New York City, WOR, Georgia, on the Savage Nation.
How are you, Michael? It's a great pleasure to talk to you. Listen, I'm one of the suspenders, horrible Ivy League graduates. I came up all the way through it, spent years running money in New York, and then left, went up to New Hampshire, and was a carpenter for about 6 years.
Okay. And so what's the point of the call?
Well, I'm back here. I'm doing it again. And I got to say that there's really nothing that makes you feel better than actually making something.
You're saying you left the investment world to actually do something?
I left it. I went to do it. And then, I don't know what got into me. I can't.
George, let's talk about the psychology of those guys. Do they realize that they're living in a fantasy world?
I think so. I think it's pretty evident right now with 50,000 people getting chopped in New York.
Well, if 50,000 people get fired here and 35,000 people get fired there, why are there no effects on the street? Why don't we see the effects on the street? For example, during the Great Depression, we heard that financiers threw themselves out of windows because they realized they were broke. What is the difference today?
You know, I really don't know. I think it's a lot of hope that you and everybody else who's probably listening who actually, you know, gets their hands dirty and gets burned at work or, you know, gets splinters is gonna end up spending money for us.
Well, is it because there were no bailouts in the 1920s, or were there bailouts? I mean, I studied it slightly, and as I understand it, it was when FDR put in the equivalent of bailouts that he made it worse rather than better.
Well, you know, I think that's true, but there was definitely an accumulation of wealth during that period, but it just, you know, the systems were not as widespread. There were, you know, the average man didn't own a share of stock. The average man had cash in a bank account if he was lucky.
So, or he put it under his mattress if he was smart.
Right, exactly.
All right, thanks for the call. 1-800-449-82. Now they want to bail out the auto industries. You know, I have spoken on this for a long time, even before others in the business were talking about it, and I'm actually for a limited bailout of several auto companies, not all of them. I am not for bailing out Chrysler because it's owned by a private equity firm. 90% of it is owned by a group of vulture capitalists, in my opinion. I wouldn't bail them out. I'd let Chrysler die. I would bail out Ford and GM if there was a trade-off with the unions. If they reduced health benefits, if they reduced pensions, and they reduced wages to those provided by the Japanese auto companies that are building cars in America, I would say if they were on par with them, I would consider a bailout. There would also have to be an awful lot of given other ways. Now, you say, well, why bail them out? Because they're fundamentally important to the survival of America from the point of view of national security. I am the only one, apparently, in the United States of America's media who understands that our tanks were built or still are built by a division, I think, of the General Motors Corporation. Would you like to farm out the building of our tanks to our little friends from Beijing? Would you like to turn our shipbuilding over to our little friends from North Korea? What is wrong with you people? Don't you understand what I'm talking about? No, in fact, it's in the national interest to bail these companies out, but not to bail out the bums who drove the companies off the cliff. Yes, they do have to give up their corporate jets. Yes, they have to give up their bonuses. Yes, they have to give up the perks of a country club life, which they do not deserve because they didn't earn them. And yes, the worker has to stop living as though he is an owner because he is not an owner. He's only a worker. And yes, the worker has to start reporting for duty instead of reporting for diversity training. And yes, the worker has to stop demanding that the government provide him with for every twitch and every complaint and every feeling and every toe ache another doctor visit. Yes, there are a lot of things that have to happen when a country tightens its belt. Will it happen? I have no idea. Should it happen? You betcha. Coming up next, Cliff Kincaid on toasting socialism right here on the Savage Nation. In approximately a minute, you're going to hear about toasting socialism. I don't know what that means. I did the interview, but I don't remember that title. I don't know whether it means we should toast socialism or welcome socialism, but I do know that we have socialism. I want somebody to understand what I'm saying, so listen to this interview and get back to me. Joining us today is Cliff Kincaid with Accuracy and Media to tell us how the demise of our country was toasted not only by the G20 leaders, but by our own president, G.W. Bush himself. Cliff Kincaid, welcome back to the Savage Nation.
Michael, thanks for having me on the show again.
In your recent article, you talk of the global socialist toasting victory over America. What do you mean by that?
America has been cut down to size economically. Welcome to the new global order. It has finally arrived. I thought they would wait until President Obama took office, but no, they've accomplished this under the, quote, conservative Republican presidency of George W. Bush, whose legacy, if you can call it that, will be socialism. And this is not only at home in terms of the bailout of Wall Street and the takeover of our financial institutions by the federal government, but globally, internationally. And what I was focusing on was the November 15th International Summit here in Washington, D.C., where we had the leaders of what are called the G20 countries, including the president of Communist China and the king of Saudi Arabia, coming to town to be toasted by President Bush in enjoying a sumptuous feast, a rack of lamb, $300 a bottle of wine. But really, they were toasting the decline of the United States, the delegation of the United States into second or third rate status internationally. That's what's happening here. And I'm afraid it has set the stage perfectly for President Obama, with his background of revolutionary Marxism, to take full advantage of it.
Rack of lamb feasts and $300 bottles of wine. Where is the outrage over this?
Well, I'm starting to hear from a lot of people who are outraged. I know I'm outraged. Michael, I've been here in Washington for 30 years. I came up to Washington, D.C. in the summer of 1978. That's when I got my first job at Accuracy and Media from Ames founder Reed Irvine. I've been through a lot. I was here cheering on the Reagan administration and the battle against communism in Central America. We, of course, eventually saw Soviet-style communism decline. But now, strangely, we're seeing the victory of socialism in the United States. I never thought we would come to this point. And that's why I'm outraged. I'm angry. And I'm hearing from a lot of people who are not only angry over seeing their stocks decline and losing their jobs, but over what's happened to the great, once great, United States. Here's one email I got from somebody in response to the AIM article at AIM.org that you mentioned. He said it this way. He said, "I just finished reading the menu." He's referring to the menu for the G20 November 15th summit here in Washington, D.C. "I've just finished reading the menu that I and the U.S. taxpayers just bought these idiots and thieves. $300 bottles of wine, racks of lamb." And he says, "Does the image of Nero fiddling while Rome burns come to mind?"
Exactly.
And he goes on to say, "What if Bush had just announced that the menu was going to reflect the seriousness of the situation? Maybe a good minestrone soup and some good Carlo Rossi Red." Well, I found out Carlo Rossi Red sells for about $6.99 a bottle. But, of course, that's not good enough for the global elite who were really here on the 15th toasting the decline of the United States. And I might add at that point, Michael, it's not just an economic decline. This is going to have tremendous repercussions militarily because, look, if the United States cannot remain as a superpower economically and financially, our military power is going to decline. I mean, if we can't even maintain an auto industry, if we can't even build cars, then how are we going to build any weapons of war to defend ourselves in the future? And this is why I say it sets the stage perfectly for President Obama, because all along we know that his intention has been to turn our security and safety over to the United Nations. And maybe, I guess, the European nations are going to help protect us, or maybe we'll somehow continue to exist under the umbrella of Communist China. This is why I'm angry. Because if you examine what's happening to this country, it's the end of America as we know it. And this guy who sent me the email, he's talking about a company he runs. And he says, "Personally, I resent more and more everyone associated with my government, and especially the country club Republicans." And he refers to Bush and Treasury Secretary Paulson. And he goes on, "I may have to lay off two good guys this coming week. I'm sure they will understand that the president had to keep up the image to all these important people in Washington who came here for the summit, the king of Saudi Arabia, the Chinese president, Hu Jintao, who enjoyed all this largesse, the $300 bottle of wine, and so forth and so on." Yeah, I'm hearing a lot from people who are angry, and they should be angry. I mean, I've been not only hearing from people, but I was watching a C-SPAN show the other day where, of course, they take calls from people, and they were discussing the financial meltdown with some so-called expert, and people were calling in just angry as hell. People are losing their jobs, are losing their homes. The value of their stocks is declining. The value of their homes is declining. And yet, we've got politicians, not only from the United States, but globally here in Washington, drinking $300 a bottle of wine.
You wrote that in the declaration that Bush endorsed at this summit, there was support for the UN's Millennium Development Goals. What?
People have to understand that the looting of the American taxpayers is not over. And I'm not just talking about the proposed $25 billion bailout of the auto industry. That's peanuts. That's chicken feed. That's chicken feed compared to the $700 billion for Wall Street. That's chicken feed compared to what Federal Reserve Board Chairman Ben Bernanke says is $2 trillion. That's $2 trillion in emergency loans that the Fed has given to domestic and foreign banks. And that's right, foreign banks. Hundreds of billions of dollars have been extended in, quote, emergency loans from the U.S. taxpayer through the Federal Reserve to banks all over the world. But that's not it, because what the international elite did in that declaration on November 15th was commit, and Bush went along with this, to even more foreign aid spending on the rest of the world at the expense of the American taxpayers. And again, this sets the stage perfectly for President-elect Obama, because we had talked before about his so-called Global Poverty Act. And what this International Summit Declaration does is set the stage for that to be passed either in a lame duck session of Congress or through a new Congress under a new administration. And the Global Poverty Act, which is envisioned in this summit declaration, commits the United States to spending 0.7% of our gross national product on foreign aid. And I won't bore you with all the details, but I've been to all these UN conferences. I've studied the documents. And what that means is, by their own admission, that commits the United States to spending another $845 billion on foreign aid for the rest of the world. Not for us, for the rest of the world. And then on top of that, Obama also supports something called the Jubilee Act. This wasn't explicitly referred to in the summit declaration, but it's part of the puzzle, part of the whole ball of wax. That would cancel the debts of foreign countries to the tune of $75 billion. So you add these two bills up, these two measures, you get $920 billion, with a B, $920 billion, on top of the $2 trillion, on top of the $700 billion. And we're getting to a point where I saw a European financial newsletter today, which I trust, which had predicted the current financial crisis, saying that the United States is approaching national bankruptcy. National bankruptcy that they predict in the new year that the United States will effectively go bankrupt. We will start defaulting on our debt. So this process is going to continue. It's going to get worse. And I suppose eventually, like Iceland, which went bankrupt this year, maybe the United States will eventually have to go hat in hand to the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank for financial support, not to mention the Chinese. Hopefully they'll give us some more money, and the rich Arab states that will have to beg for some dollars for them, just like Bush was toasting the King of Saudi Arabia on November 15th. This should make anybody outraged in the United States that we've gotten to this point where we're a bankrupt nation, and now we're being cut down to size by the rest of the world as part of this new world order in which the United States is really just going to become a bit player in a new order dominated by the Europeans, the Chinese, and the rich Arabs.
Cliff Kincaid, thanks for being on the Savage Nation.
Michael, it's been great to be with you. Thanks a million.
Savage.
The left would have you believe that they're the educated ones, not those on the dumb right. That true intellectuals would always follow the left's communist ideology and agenda, and that because of the fancy schools they went to and diplomas they have, that they are the best choice for leadership. Joining us on the show today to talk about these intellectual ideas is Daniel Flynn, the author of The Conservative History of the American Left. Daniel Flynn, welcome back to the Savage Nation.
Thank you so much, Michael, for having me again.
In this past election, Obama was labeled the more intellectual of the candidates, even though he had many missteps and questionable statements. What marks one as an intellectual?
Well, I think what marks one as an intellectual, unfortunately, is style over substance. It's about politics. If you're a politician and you reflect the intellectual's political ideology, the intellectual is going to return the favor by tagging you with the intellectual label. The style over substance aspect of it, you know, being intellectual is very much is about being a poser. That, you know, do you wear a tweed jacket with a turtleneck underneath. You subscribe to the New York Times or the New Yorker. You prefer European football to American football. All of this tends to mark one as an intellectual, and this is unfortunate because these are all things that have nothing to do with one's intellect and everything to do with one's mannerisms, the way one acts. And it's not, being an intellectual is unfortunately not very much about exercising your intellect. It's about being part of the herd of independent minds.
Why do leftists always overrate the intelligence in their leaders?
Yeah, if you look at the presidents that we've had that have been intellectuals over the course of the last 100 years, they generally have been some of the presidents that are regarded as disastrous. And so certainly Woodrow Wilson, who was the president of Princeton University, he was an intellectual. Herbert Hoover, who was an engineer, he was an intellectual. Richard Nixon, a lot of people would say, was an intellectual. And so intellectuals, it doesn't necessarily disqualify you from becoming a good president, but a lot of the presidents that we've had that have been more intellectual-in-chief than commander-in-chief have been disastrous presidents. You know, I was in the United States Marine Corps for 8 years, and the Marine Corps has 14 rather famous leadership traits. They're traits like justice, judgment, initiative, dependability, so on and so forth. One thing about that list that really grabbed me is the word intelligence is not on there. And this is not to say that intelligence is not a desirable quality. It certainly is. But if you're going into battle, I don't know that there are too many people that would want to follow, say, an artist into battle. I don't know too many people that would want some snarky Mensa member as their congressman leading them. And so intelligence, yeah, it's definitely a quality that you'd want in a leader, but there are other qualities you'd want. And I suspect the reason that intellectuals tend to overvalue intelligence and to downplay everything else is that intellectuals are people who are generally intelligent, and so, yeah, they're going to overplay their own strengths and act as if they are the ideal people to be the leader or to be the president, and they're going to downplay other qualities like wisdom, like judgment, ethics, and honesty that they may not have because that would maybe disqualify them from being a good leader. It makes sense for them to overplay the one strength they have and to downplay everything else.
Well, that's why the media portrays anybody who has conservative values like they're dumb for believing in those values.
Yeah, the oldest play in the leftist playbook is to call your adversary a dummy. And we see that in presidential politics. Dwight Eisenhower was a dummy. Ronald Reagan was someone who was characterized as always taking a nap, sleepwalking through history, I believe the phrase was. Gerald Ford was a bumbling idiot portrayed that way by Chevy Chase on Saturday Night Live. Dan Quayle, George W. Bush, Sarah Palin. So if you've been watching politics for as long as I have or as long as you have, Michael, this becomes rather stale. It becomes tired that any Republican or particularly any conservative Republican that comes along is immediately labeled an idiot, whereas any Democrat, any particularly a liberal Democrat that comes along, is labeled an intellectual. And we saw this in this campaign where Barack Obama, when he bumbled and said there were 57 states in America, or Joe Biden, who made this ridiculous statement that when the stock market crashed, FDR got on the television and calmed the nation. When FDR wasn't president when the stock market crashed, television didn't come into commercial use until years later. They never get called dummies. These are just sort of passed off as the kind of gaffes you make at the end of a very long and hard day of campaigning. Teddy Kennedy, I'm a constituent of Teddy Kennedy. I have never heard the man complete a grammatical, coherent sentence in the English language, but no one is ever going to call Teddy Kennedy a dummy. They just saved that tag for Sarah Palin and Dan Quayle and Ronald Reagan. So there's a little bit of hypocrisy here. And there's a little bit of projection where you have intellectuals basically projecting the intellectual label upon those politicians who just reflect their politics. Really, all you need to join the club of intellectuals is the sort of stylistic trappings and also to subscribe to the right political ideas. And Barack Obama and Joe Biden and a lot of the other liberal Democrats do this, and that's why they're labeled intellectuals.
You use the term intellectual moron when you describe some of these people. What do you actually mean by that?
Yeah, an intellectual moron. I wrote a book called Intellectual Morons back in 2004. And for anyone who doesn't know what an intellectual moron is, it's basically someone who's blessed with great cognitive abilities, but who, because they think with their ideology rather than their brain, they're wrong a whole lot more than they're right. There's really no Rosetta Stone that's going to give you the answer to everything, but so many ideologies like Marxism believe not only that they have a single bullet theory of history, but they can order, you know, all 6 billion people living on Earth. And of course, no one or no group of men is so smart that they can order the lives of 6 billion people. And I suspect that's another reason why intellectuals so value intelligence, because their schemes depend upon having this sort of super brain that no individual or no group of individuals have. The idea that you can sort of direct and manage the affairs of people by remote thousands and thousands of miles away. And so if you were to look in the dictionary, what next to this definition that I've given you of an intellectual moron, I think you'd find a guy like Noam Chomsky, you know, the MIT professor, the linguist. Noam Chomsky is a guy, time and time again, because he relies on his ideology rather than his brain to do his thinking, he gets things wrong. And it's a shame because Noam Chomsky is probably a heck of a lot smarter than I am. But, you know, just to take one example, when he was looking at the genocide in Cambodia back in the 1970s, he claimed that this was a hoax, a media creation by the New York Times, and the credible estimates had it that at most, you know, 1,000 people or so had died. Now, what we know about Cambodia now is that more than 1 million people were killed. The whole country was forced to don, you know, black uniforms as if Cambodia was a giant sports team. They cut off people's ears and made them eat their ears. They killed people wearing glasses because they represented, you know, vanity. They killed people in hospitals because they believed they were shirkers who wouldn't work the field. Noam Chomsky got it horribly wrong. He was, you know, essentially an apologist for genocide during the Cambodian genocide, during the Khmer Rouge's reign there. And yet, if he's so smart, why is he constantly making these sort of idiotic mistakes? And I would venture to guess that the reason for this is because he doesn't do his own thinking. He lets his ideology be his guide. And when you let ideology be your guide, you're going to get lost.
Well, what can we on the right do to combat the elitism of the left?
Well, I think, first of all, some of the criticism of the right in the last, say, 5 to 10 years, I don't think is all that much off. Unfortunately, a lot of the books that have been put out by conservatives have been dumbed down, become more of a soundbite, blog-dependent culture. And I suspect that there are a lot of people, both on the left and right, aren't doing a whole lot of reading. And to me, what really makes an intellectual is reading. And I would suggest that to anyone out there listening that, you know, go pick up a good conservative book. And that's probably the best way to combat this. And I think we have to combat this as conservatives because, you know, for the past 8 years or so, we have had too many folks on the right who've just seen fit to mauve whatever George W. Bush or some of his lackeys are saying, and look where it has got us right now. It's not a very pretty picture.
Daniel Flynn, thanks for being on the Savage Nation.
Michael, thank you for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Savage.
It is the Savage Nation. I'm back with you again, and we just got Bush's pardon list. That's right. President George W. Bush has granted pardons to 14 individuals. He has commuted the prison sentences of two others convicted of misdeeds ranging from drug offenses to tax evasion, from wildlife violations to bank embezzlement. Now, I'm going to read you some of those pardoned because I don't know any of the people, but I will say this. I would like to know why Randy Duke Cunningham, a Republican from California, a certified Vietnam War ace and a great man who has been in prison for a number of years right now for public corruption, and rightly so. But what Randy Cunningham did is nothing compared to what these gangsters on Wall Street are doing today. Only instead of going to a federal prison, they're going directly to the Obama White House. So Randy Duke Cunningham, a certified Vietnam War ace, rots in a federal prison. And I would like to ask you, the listeners of the Savage Nation, to try to lobby for his pardon. I don't know the man. I never met the man. But there's a soft spot in me for Vietnam War aces. And Randy Duke Cunningham, a former Republican congressman in California, deserves to be commuted and released from prison. He's already paid his price. The only reason he was given 8.5 years is because of a psychopathic U.S. attorney put in there by the Clintons. He was being hammered by a Clinton U.S. attorney. Sure, he committed a crime, but as I say to you, what Duke Cunningham did, many of you don't even remember who he is, was nothing compared to what Secretary Paulson and Bernanke are doing on a daily basis, in my opinion. Of course, they're doing it legally because they know how to work the business. So here are some of the individuals who were commuted. Let's see. Leslie Owen Collier, you should do a rolling of the drums, of Charleston, Mo. She was convicted for unauthorized use of a pesticide and violating the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act. Well, I like eagles, but I... Milton Kirkcordis of Rapid City, South Dakota, convicted of conspiracy to violate the Lacey Act, which prohibits importation in the country of wildlife taken in violation of conservation laws. All right. I don't know what these cases mean. Brenda Jean Dolan's Helmer, Fort Worth, for reporting and helping cover up a crime. What crime? Andrew Foster Harley of Falls Church, Virginia, commuted by George Bush, pardoned by Bush. He had been convicted of wrongful use and distribution of marijuana and cocaine. How do they decide to release one coke dealer and not another? Does anyone know how this works? You got a rolling of the drums. OB Gene Helton. OB Gene Helton of Rossville, Georgia was released, whose offense was unauthorized acquisition of food stamps. I'm reading all of those pardoned by George Bush today. Roll the next one, please. Geneva Yvonne Hogg of Jacksonville, Florida, released, convicted of bank embezzlement. I guess she's going to go right to work for Paulson. Next, roll the drums. Next person pardoned by Bush is Paul Julian McCurdy of Sulphur, Oklahoma. He was sentenced for misapplication of bank funds. He was pardoned in order to go to work for the Obama administration. Robert Earl Mohan, Jr. of Grant, Alabama, who had been convicted of conspiracy to distribute marijuana. He's been pardoned, so he can go to work for the city of San Francisco as the drug czar. Ronald Allen Molroff of Los Angeles, who was convicted for unlawful use of a telephone in a narcotics felony. He's been released by George Bush. I don't know the rest. Bush also commuted the prison sentences of John Edward Forte of North Brunswick, New Jersey, and James Russell Harris of Detroit, Mich. Both were convicted of cocaine offenses. Under the Constitution, the president's power to issue pardons is absolute and cannot be overruled. That's nice. That's great. It's good to be king. Former Rep. Randy Duke Cunningham, Republican, California, has served, as far as I know, about 4 years or more of his sentence. It is time for him to be pardoned. Also, what about the Border Patrol agents, Ramos and Campion? Why are they still rotting in prison when all they did was apprehend a drug dealer? Does anyone know why they are being persecuted by the Bush administration? Okay, there we go. If you care to comment on any of these topics, do so with another host. I'm going to go to the callers. Chris Sacramento, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Dr. Savage, it's a pleasure and a privilege to speak with you today. Question. What's the difference between our financial advisors and investors of the 20s and 30s and compared to the CEOs and stuff of today? Answer, men back then had dignity, integrity, and they all shared the common goal of furthering mankind and society as a whole. Today we're left with a bunch of...
When you say furthering mankind, these people would laugh at you. They would think you're a fool.
I agree, but, you know, unfortunately, that's what that's people with integrity and dignity did. You know, and unfortunately now we're just left with a bunch of snot-nosed...
Well, we know that. We know who they are, but what are we going to do about it when we don't have a government of the people, by the people, and for the people? If we, the people, want to redress our grievances, I can guarantee you if you polled America today, Democrat, Republican, race, anything you want, overwhelmingly 85 to 90% of the people would like to see the CEOs of these companies that are getting bailed out give up their perks and also turn over their houses and their personal possessions as collateral to receive this money. Yet they're not being asked to turn over any collateral. Could you get a loan for any amount from anybody without collateral, Chris?
I wouldn't give anything to anyone.
Okay, thank you. Well, very good. Pittsburgh, PA. Ralph, you're on the Savage Nation. Topic, please.
Hello, Michael. Dead Man's Pants. How about Goodwill Man's Pants? I loved your book. I have Psychological Nudity here. And
oh, what do you mean Goodwill Man's Pants? You mean you grew up wearing Goodwill pants?
I had no shame. My father was the one who pushed it, and even to this day, I still shop Goodwill, and I am what I would call a semi-professional. I have a finance degree.
It's funny. No, you know, there are a lot of people with some wealth who are extremely frugal, bordering on the level of a piker. There are many cases of people with a lot of money who continue to act as though they have no money. And it's not a matter of being cheap. It's a matter of how they think and how they see the world. For example, I turn lights off in my house. My family goes crazy. If I visit relatives and they live in a nice house, they say, Lee, it's not your house. Stop turning lights off. Why do you do it? I don't even think about it. I turn them off. I can't help myself. Now, they say, well, what are you doing it for? You're trying to save money? I say, it's not the money. I don't like changing light bulbs. There's something about it. I just don't like leaving lights on when I'm not home. Do you know what I'm saying?
Most certainly. That's hilarious. I do the same thing, no matter whether I'm at work or anywhere. Also, separate bedrooms. I have a comment.
My story on separate bedrooms, it's the best thing in the world. In fact, the rich have known this for centuries.
I love it. But have you noticed, and maybe I'm just pulling things out of the air, but people who have been married 30, 40, 50 years have lived in separate bedrooms, peaceful coexistence, but they've made it work.
You mean lived in separate bedrooms?
And, of course, still we're husband and wife.
Yeah, of course you can still get together, but this concept of getting in a little bed together for the rest of your life is a prison sentence. It's guaranteed to destroy a marriage because after 90 days, it's been studied by Swiss psychiatrists for centuries ago, and they discovered that after 90 days, the ardor wears off, and then you want nothing other than your own bedroom.
Exactly, and I truly believe that, and I think that's a great
story. How can you sleep with a stranger in the same bed? I mean, think about it. From the time you're an infant, after you leave your mother's arms, after you're through nursing, you sleep in a bed by yourself. So for 20-some-odd years, you sleep alone in a bed with the occasional, let us say, pleasure of the company of a person of the opposite sex along the way. Then you get married, and then now suddenly you have to get used to the creaks and the groans and the movements. It's virtually impossible to get a night's sleep.
It's unnatural, and
it is, but the king, the rich, the royalty always knew this, and the poor know it because they live in separate zip codes. They're usually running away from alimony. It's time the middle class caught. That's going to be the last word tonight of the Savage Nation. Separate bedrooms.
Savage.